This is 1 in 6 Billion,
a podcast about diabetes and genes, with me, Maggie Shepherd,
and me, Andrew Hattersley.
So I thought there's got to be a better way of getting this information out there, because always my motivation is about trying to improve patient care. That's really the bottom line for me.
So welcome back to the 1 in 6 Billion podcast. And today is going to be another in the special series where we talk about researchers coming to Exeter. And it's a great pleasure this afternoon to be talking with Maggie Shepherd.
So thanks. Yeah, look forward to talking about my career.
So Maggie, do you want to go right back to the beginning and how you got interested in nursing in the first place?
Yeah, so I think I was about 15 when I decided I wanted to be a nurse, and I started by volunteering with the local Red Cross, and I also volunteered at the local hospital. I think in those days the regulations weren't quite so strict, and I remember at the age of 15 or 16 pitching up to the local hospital and helping feed patients and things like that. So it was something I wanted to do from quite early on, really.
And then did you apply to different nursing schools, or how does it work?
Yeah, so I was brought up in Kent and I applied to 5 different nursing schools in London, was offered a place at all of them. But in fact, it was King's College Hospital that really the interview just felt right. And I thought, that's the place for me. So I started in 1981 doing my nursing training. And at that time, it was general nursing training. So you got to do experience in all the different specialities. So you spent time in paediatrics, geriatrics, psychiatry, midwifery. You had a really good rounded training in all those different areas.
And did you feel you'd made the right decision as you went through the different bits of nursing?
Yeah, absolutely felt nursing was right for me. I think the only bit of my training that I didn't particularly enjoy was when we had to work in theatres, so where people were having operations. And I realised the reason I didn't enjoy that so much is actually you couldn't talk to the patients because they were anaesthetised.
Yeah, that's his problem.
But actually all the other areas of care I really enjoyed.
And what did you go on to do having qualified as a nurse?
Well, the last ward that I worked on before I qualified was a bit of an odd combination. I don't think we'd have it now, but the ward was separated half into patients who had diabetes and half into patients who had cancer. And I really enjoyed that ward. I liked the continuity of care with the patients. The patients with diabetes, some of them actually stayed in for months on end, some of them with foot ulcers and things like that. So you really got to know the patients quite well. And I enjoyed that. So I applied there for a staff nurse post. And that was my first post when I qualified. And I worked there for a year and a half before I thought I needed to go on and get some other experience. But it was quite interesting because in those days we had a room allocated as a coma room for patients who came in diabetic ketoacidosis. So patients with diabetes who were very sick with a very high blood sugar. So you got to do some quite intensive nursing for those patients, but also patients who were in there for a long period of time, as I mentioned, for their diabetes care.
And so what did you go on to do, having done this initial year and a half on the diabetes ward in King's?
Yeah, I thought then I just needed to get some different experience. So I worked on a surgical ward, which was really kind of gastrointestinal surgery. And we had patients with liver problems as well. That was one area that King's specialised in. But I didn't really feel surgical nursing was for me because the patients, you know, they'd come in, they'd have the surgery, off they'd go, you wouldn't see them again. And so you didn't get the opportunity to build up that kind of relationship with patients.
So what did you opt for to try and find that situation where you could keep the relationship going?
Well, it was interesting because at that point I found that the more senior you got on the wards, I was a senior staff nurse on the surgical ward, and the more senior you got, the more you seemed to be pushed to do managerial duties like sorting out the off-duty rota, and the more removed you seemed to be from patients. So I felt at a little bit of a crossroads there, and I was trying to think, well, okay, what should I be doing next? What's of interest? And a job came up in the diabetes clinic with Peter Watkins and David Pike. And I thought, oh, well, I'll go and work there and just while I'm kind of working out what I want to do long term. But that was quite interesting because you got the opportunity to start doing some education with patients as well. And in fact, one of the consultants who joined the diabetes clinic then, Paul Drury, who's now working in New Zealand, he also worked part-time at Greenwich District Hospital. And that was at the time when they were just starting diabetes specialist nurse roles. So he flagged up to me that they'd got a new opportunity at Greenwich and might that be something I considered applying for.
So it seems remarkable that there used to be a time when we didn't have diabetes specialist nurses, because now working in diabetes, they are so key and so central. The idea that you could have a department that wasn't mainly consisting of diabetes specialist nurses is remarkable. I mean, I'm just interested in those people you're working with were some of the leaders of UK diabetes, and certainly Peter Watkins and David Pike were probably the two leading diabetologists at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. And we had Mike Edmonds, who led the foot service at King's, who's still been working there. And yeah, really phenomenal people who were interested in research, but that wasn't really something I got involved with at that point in time. But yeah, really dynamic team of individuals.
And so then you set off to Greenwich. How far is that for a non-Londoner?
Yeah, so not very far from where I was, probably about half an hour's travel from where I was living. But I was the first diabetes specialist nurse appointed at Greenwich, and I really enjoyed that post. I stayed there for 8 years. And what I liked about it was you had the autonomy within the role. You know, you could see patients right from diagnosis to starting them on insulin. We were setting up educational programs. We were seeing patients from teenage years right up to adults, a mix of patients with type 1 and type 2 diabetes, and quite a rewarding role. And I got the opportunity while I was there to undertake a degree. When I started nursing, it wasn't a degree course, so I did a BSc Honours in Health Studies, one day a week release from my job as a diabetes specialist nurse. But it was a great team to work with, and yeah, I really enjoyed it.
And were you the leader of the diabetes specialist nurses at Greenwich?
Yeah, so there were only two or three of us actually ever within that service when I was there. So it was a small team. But I think just being the first one in the door, it was great to be able to start introducing ideas and initiatives. For example, group education was just beginning in those days, and using patients to help with the group education actually, incorporating the patient's stories and things like that.
So why did you stop doing that? That seems to be the perfect job.
So I was moving down to Devon. So I still wanted to stay in diabetes. That's where my expertise was. And so I thought I'd continue a role as a diabetes specialist nurse, but in Devon. So I remember sending my CV round. I couldn't see any jobs advertised at the time, but I sent my CV round to the team in Exeter, as well as other trusts within about 45 minutes to an hour of Exeter. And I remember you and your team kind of responded to me and suggested we might meet up.
Yes, I was in a diabetes clinic, and in this day it was in a very small little hut, and the lead nurse was Jean Sykes, and she came rushing into my office between patients and said, "I've just seen somebody and you've got to employ her. She's looking for a job. Surely you can find a job for her in your research team." And that was you.
And I remember you contacting me and saying, "Oh, well, are you going up to the Diabetes UK conference?" And that was the year you had your R.D. Lawrence lecture. And so you said, "Well, come along and meet me after the R.D. Lawrence lecture." So I remember sitting and listening to your lecture and thinking, you know, wow, this is really impressive. But actually, I probably didn't understand any of the genetics that you were talking about. But I remember meeting you after that. And then I came down to meet you in Exeter and have another conversation again about the possibility of working with the team.
Yeah. And again, we were really great help came from Diabetes UK, or the British Diabetic Association as it was then. And Moira Murphy identified that finding the families was crucial, that if you were going to do any genetic studies in the genetic form of diabetes that comes on when you're an adult, so that's maturity onset diabetes of the young, that you needed to collect these families. And she provided funding for you to do that role.
Yeah, so I remember you offered me a kind of diabetes research nurse job initially. And as you say, you had to go and find some funding from Diabetes UK for that. And I was thinking a diabetes research nurse post actually wasn't my first choice. I was looking for a diabetes specialist nurse post. But I thought, well, that's okay. I'll take the diabetes research nurse post to start with, and then there may be a possibility of a specialist role after that. But in fact, when I started, what I realised was that the research nurse post didn't take me away from patients, which is what I was worried about. I was actually going around, as you said, travelling across Devon to collect samples from families thought to have genetic types of diabetes, and collect blood samples, take family histories, take clinical details, bring those samples back to the lab for the lab to look and see could they find a genetic cause. And I remember I had to go and take the samples fasting. So first thing in the morning before the families had had anything to eat and drink, which sounds not too bad, but we were in Exeter and there was this big family in North Devon, which is over an hour's drive away, and they were farmers. So they were up at about 4 a.m. So I remember leaving the house in the dark on several occasions with my little centrifuge in the back of the car and all my blood bottles ready to take the samples at some unearthly hour of the night so I could get there before they had their breakfast and their first cup of tea.
Yeah, and that family and all the families you collected have turned out to be crucial for our subsequent research. And I suppose what was happening at the same time was that Sian Ellard was setting up the laboratory and we had our first PhD student, which was Tim Frayling, and probably around the same Diabetes UK meeting that a work from Graham Bell was announced that had found the second big genetic cause. We heard in the first one of the special series about how myself and Philippe Fragel in Paris had been involved in finding the first gene called glucokinase. But the second and third genes, HNF1 alpha and HNF4 alpha, were suddenly discovered, which meant that we were able to immediately use your families for testing if they had this new cause.
So I suppose at that time, what I was beginning to think is that this was really new information for patients and also for many of the diabetes healthcare professionals looking after them as well. Having worked in diabetes for 8 years before, all of this genetic information was very new to me. And I was thinking, well, this is going to come quite as a shock to some of the patients. And how are they going to understand and make sense of this information?
Well, you're absolutely right. And you're also right when you say it was the healthcare professionals, because it wasn't just you, it was all healthcare professionals. We'd never had genetic forms of diabetes before. So we'd never had any idea about dealing with genetic information. I remember being a bit shocked when one of the experts said, oh, well, because it's inherited from your parents from generation to generation, we know about that because Huntington Chorea is like that. And this was something very different from Huntington's Chorea.
Absolutely. And I remember at this point in time, because we'd only got funding for my role for the first couple of years from Diabetes UK, you were looking and thinking, well, how could you get some more funding for my position? You came along and you suggested I might want to apply for a PhD and get some funding that way. And I don't know if I've ever told you this or not, but I was kind of horrified. Because at that point in time, I didn't know any other nurses who'd got a PhD. I thought you had to be super bright and I thought you had to be working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I thought, you know, that's probably not me, but anyway, I'll apply for the funding because that's what you're suggesting. And I knew the chances of getting the funding were actually pretty slim. It was less than a 1 in 10 chance, I think. And I remember going to this interview, putting a proposal together about a PhD, which would be looking at attitudes to genetic testing amongst patients and professionals using qualitative methods and interviewing the families. And I was kind of thinking, well, I probably won't get the funding, so that's okay. We'll find the funding somewhere else. And then lo and behold, I went to this interview with 10 really scary looking people around the table interviewing me, came out and I just thought, oh, that was horrendous. I won't get the funding. But then certainly I did get the funding. And then here I was on the route to do a PhD.
But you've been pretty proactive in deciding because, and one of the contrasts between us came out as we talked about understanding attitudes, because as a numbers person, I was very keen that we would study things with questionnaires and you'd get a score. And And I think you certainly didn't want to do that.
When I was looking for another supervisor to help with my PhD, I found Andy Sparks, who's now a professor up in Leeds, who was an amazing qualitative researcher who did research with individuals who used to play rugby and had been injured with a spinal cord injury. And some of his qualitative research, as soon as I met him, I just thought the depth of understanding he's got by doing individual in-depth interviews just really gave you a level of understanding that you would just never have got through a questionnaire. I think listening to people and hearing people's stories is really the best way of understanding what they're actually going through, or just trying to get an even a small insight into what somebody's actually going through. So for me, qualitative research was the really best way to approach this.
And just for the listeners, can you explain what qualitative research involves?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's really finding out from an individual or a group of individuals their perspectives on a condition or a situation. So typically it's either conducted through individual interviews, which are then tape recorded and then what we call transcribed, so written out word for word afterwards, to then look within that for the data, which is really the themes and the key issues coming out from that data. So you'll use very open-ended questions and really let the individuals talk about their own experience. And you can then probe and get a little bit more detail as needed. But it's really trying to understand things from that individual's perspective.
And did you, when you were talking with families about the diabetes in their family, get any unusual explanations?
Yeah, absolutely. There was one family who, when I asked questions around, you know, why did they think there were so many individuals within their family who got diabetes, and they were talking about a family recipe for chutney and how this recipe for chutney had been passed down through the generations and nobody outside the family had got this recipe for chutney, which, you know, certainly wasn't what I was expecting. But I think what it does show you is that if individuals have very strong, what we talk about as lay beliefs, or really strong beliefs about why something's happened, it's really important to understand that, because actually there's no point going in with that family and talking in very complex language about the genetics. It's better to know what they're thinking, and then you can explain it in a more appropriate context.
And I suppose it was around this time that we were telling them about the genes, but also at times we were telling them they could change their treatment as a result of that. Did that have a big impact on them?
Yeah, absolutely. So following my PhD, I was successful in getting a postdoc award, so another lot of funding to do some more research. And the first award I got, I was looking at exactly that, the impact of changing from insulin injections to tablet treatment. And I suppose one of the main findings of that was actually how challenging that was for some. As an individual who doesn't have diabetes, I might think it sounds amazing to be able to just stop your insulin injections and change to tablets. But what the qualitative research showed was that for these families, they'd grown up, many of them, with their identity linked in with them being someone who injected insulin. And then telling them that they didn't have type 1 diabetes, which they'd previously been told. And with the context of type 1 diabetes, people are told they need insulin for survival. And so we are then giving them a very different message once they'd had the genetic test result. And so we really found through that work that these patients needed a lot of support in coming off insulin as well.
It's interesting because I think we all thought it would be easy and everybody would want to come off it. And it was a bit bizarre. We were taking a blood sample and then going back to them saying, oh, you don't need insulin anymore. And that's quite a brave thing to say from just doing a blood test.
Yeah, absolutely. And often these families were from across the UK. You know, here we were in Devon. We hadn't even met the families. So we had to be very careful and make sure, obviously, that the diagnosis was right and that we were able to successfully change their treatment.
And I think as you were doing this, you were coming across professionals. And what were you finding when you met other healthcare professionals working in diabetes?
Well, I think I was very aware that this was very new information for them as well. And one thing that I thought was really important was obviously you and other members of the team and myself included were going out and giving talks to raise awareness of this. We were publishing papers, but often the sessions we'd get at a conference were kind of on the afternoon at the end of the conference, and they weren't always very well attended, to be quite honest, because many people thought, oh, that's genetic session, I'm not interested in that. So I thought there's got to be a better way of getting this information out there, because always my motivation is about trying to improve patient care. That's really the bottom line for me. And so I wanted to develop a strategy that patients, wherever they lived in the UK, would get the right diagnosis. So in 2002, I set up the Genetic Diabetes Nurse Project, or the Modi Linked Nurse Project, as we called it then, which was training up diabetes specialist nurses. They'd come down to visit us 3 times a year in Exeter. We'd do some training for them, give them some PowerPoint slides, and ask them to give presentations across their region to help raise awareness of these rare genetic types of diabetes as well, to help other healthcare professionals become more familiar with it.
So you're doing that approach of really trying to have local experts that you are educating. But I think then the national opportunity came up, which you grasped with both hands when you got the Janet Kinson Award, which meant that you were going to give a lecture at the National Diabetes Meeting. And this wasn't going to be on a Friday afternoon when everybody's gone home and the genetic sessions are typically done, but was actually going to be prime time with everybody in the audience.
Yeah, that was a fantastic opportunity. So that's one of the award lectures at Diabetes UK, where it tends to be attended by over 1,000 delegates. And that was an opportunity to really give a talk using patient examples of these patients who'd been sat in clinics with the wrong diagnosis, many times thinking they had type 1 diabetes, and then through these patient stories, giving examples of how they got the right diagnosis and changed their treatment. Because for me, I think telling patient stories are things that a lot of healthcare professionals can identify with. Genetics can sound very complicated, but actually if you bring it back to a patient, then most people in the audience will be able to identify with that and understand.
And how were you giving the patients voices? How did you do that in your lecture?
Well, so many cases I'd interviewed the patients, but we'd also taken video recordings with the patient consent. And so as part of the lecture, I was able to play little clips from those patients so they could tell their own stories, which they could do far more effectively than I ever could.
Yeah, and I think it had just an enormous impact sitting in the audience watching Maggie give her this talk. It was one of the first interviews I'd seen people use video in it. So that technology was quite a brave thing to do. But when you heard someone say things like, "This is the best blood test I've ever had. It has transformed my life," and it was the patient telling you that, it was so powerful. And I think so many people in that audience immediately thought, I need to know about this. This is something that is important for patients. So Maggie, you'd come in as somebody who was a diabetes specialist nurse, and then you developed your own area of research, which nobody else in the world was doing. Did you then feel a desire to go back and become the diabetes specialist nurse again?
To be honest, no, I didn't, because I really enjoyed the role that I was doing. I actually loved the variety. So I was still doing clinics with you, specialist clinics for these patients with rare genetic types of diabetes, and advising clinicians about management of the patient. So I still had the patient contact. And so we'd set up a 2-day course that healthcare professionals could come and learn more about rare genetic types of diabetes. And I was also able to do my own research, which was with patients as well. So I felt that the role was really varied and didn't want to go back to what I was doing previously. And I think the other point was I was also really supported to do further education myself. So in the role I was doing, I thought I needed credibility in terms of genetic counselling. So I undertook some detailed courses in genetic counselling as well as medical education. So I was able to kind of further develop those skills as well.
And I think it was very interesting because you came from a completely different professional background from Sian, who came from a scientific one, and myself, who came from a doctor's background. What do you think you brought as a nurse that wasn't there?
That's a really good question, because I think it could have been easy to feel intimidated actually working with all these really super bright individuals who are just, you know, finding new genes and doing all sorts of brilliant things. But I thought actually there's a real strength in having different disciplines within the team. What I could offer was something different. And what I could offer is that link with the patients, raising the patient's voice and their stories and showing the patient's perspectives, as well as kind of taking information back to healthcare professionals. That was quite a deliberate kind of thought as to, okay, well, what can I offer here within the team?
And I think that decision to look at a qualitative psychology approach to research fitted a lot more with your ideas about what nursing could bring to research.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think one thing I have to correct is you are super bright, Maggie, and there's absolutely no doubt about that. And really, that what you brought was a enormous strengthening to the team, because I think it came from each of us having our own different strengths and all appreciating the strengths that other people had. I know that Sian, working in the laboratory, really appreciated the contact that you gave her with the patients.
Yeah, I think for me within the team, there's just a real passion with everybody about making a difference and improving care and enabling people to develop their strengths and take a slightly different approach. And I think within the team, everybody's role is valued. It doesn't matter what discipline you come from. Everybody's got a part to play to making a better outcome.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that one of the things we've tried to do is to take people and maximize the strengths that they bring rather than mold them into something that we think is the right finished product. And that diversity of backgrounds has greatly added to the progress that's been possible to make for the field. Brilliant. Well, we will carry on with the special series, and next time we'll be hearing from Professor Sian Ellard, who was, as we've heard, the third member, again working in a very different field as she set up the genetics laboratory.
Great. Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you very much, Maggie.
So if you enjoyed this episode and would like to find out more, please visit 1in6b.com.